Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Here's today's reminder: the financial crisis has not yet left us. Too Big to Fail is back in the news. That 47% we've been hearing about, how do you think they're going to vote in a couple of weeks? And the Chinese economy at 200 miles an hour. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Thursday, the 20th of September. Glad as always to have you with us. All right, so it's been what? Probably a couple of months since the phrase "too big to fail" has been uttered into a Marketplace microphone. Well, we're going to have to start the streak over after the broadcast today, gang, because one of the biggest of the TBTFs, as we like to say around here, Bank of America, is getting smaller. B of A announced not long ago it's going to cut 30,000 jobs over the next couple of years. Today, the Wall Street Journal reports the bank could be halfway to that goal by this December, all the way done a year ahead of schedule. Our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore explains how it's going to get there and what a leaner B of A might look like.
A year ago, Bank of America announced it would cut one out of every 10 jobs. Ever since then, a sword has been hanging over the heads of its employees.
You know, you walk out back onto that trading desk or that banking floor or anywhere else, if business levels don't start picking up very quickly, it's just a matter of time before there's another round coming.
That's Michael Driscoll, a professor at Adelphi University. He knows from working on Wall Street that profit is king.
They have a responsibility to shareholders to maximize shareholder value, not maximize employee value.
Employees and shareholders alike are still paying the price for Bank of America's enthusiasm during the housing boom. Distressed mortgages, mostly from Countrywide Financial, cost Bank of America around $8 billion a year.
The purchase of Countrywide was probably one of the worst business decisions ever. Having made that error, it's probably not surprising that they're downsizing that effort.
Cornelius Hurley is a law professor at Boston University. Bank of America is shrinking its mortgage business as part of the cuts. The bank has a rule now. Housing recovery or no, Bank of America won't give a mortgage to anyone who's not already a customer.
That does come at a particularly bad time as we're trying to get more banks lending in this area. And to the extent that this is one of the largest banks in the country, that's not helpful.
I asked several experts whether big banks like Bank of America can really give themselves a makeover. The common answer was this: they have no other choice. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
It takes a special kind of person to get excited about a bureaucratic data dump, but that's just the way we roll here at Marketplace. News today from the Census Bureau had some possibly hopeful signs for the economy. And among the figures that jumped out at us was this: after years of hunkering down in mom and dad's basement to weather the recession, more young adults are taking the leap and moving out. Some of them, anyway. From the Wealth and Poverty Desk, here's Chrissy Clark.
Meet Hallie Moberg from Dayton, Ohio. Graduated from college a year ago, applied for 35 jobs just in the last couple months, and so far, no takers. For the meantime, she's back home living with mom.
I started my life, and then I've come back, and I'm in the middle of her life again. I feel kind of bored and frustrated. I'm glad I have Netflix.
But next month, Moberg's taking her Netflix and taking a leap. She's moving out to Chicago to look for work there. Across the country, there are a lot of young adults taking the same leap, and that's a good sign, according to demographer Mark Mather at the Population Reference Bureau.
These are people who are just starting out, so if they're not confident about their futures, it's kind of a barometer of how the population overall is doing.
That barometer seems to be going up. The latest numbers show that 13.6% of young adults live at home, a half percent fewer than a year ago.
You know, that national trend is very good news.
Sarah Bird Sharps co-directs a study called Measure of America with the Social Science Research Council.
But not everybody has the same tools for achieving these dreams. And we perhaps focus too little on, you know, disconnected communities where people don't have necessarily the kind of social networks, you know, to link kids to job training programs, to apprenticeships, et cetera.
Take young African-American men. Fewer of them were living at home this year, too, in pace with the national trend. But they have a bigger trend they're up against. Currently, 29% live at home, compared to just 14% of young white men. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, it was a slow start and then a long, slow climb back to break even. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I know it's only Thursday, but if you had to pick a soundtrack for this week, this would be a pretty good one.
47% of Americans.
47% of Americans.
47% of the country that doesn't pay income tax.
Of the many questions raised by Governor Romney's inelegant remarks, one of the most immediate is, will they matter come November?
And the latest poll numbers suggest
margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said.
Here to give us an attitude check, as he does every week, is Frank Newport. He's the editor-in-chief at Gallup. Frank, it's good to talk to you again.
Good to be with you.
One of the things Governor Romney said in this video is that this 47% of Americans who pay no federal income tax isn't going to vote for him. Can we say that income levels, which is kind of what a 47% is a proxy for, are predictive of how people are going to vote?
Kind of they are, but by no means are they a dominant predictor. In fact, religion, race, and whether or not you're married, all of those are more important demographic predictors of who you're going to vote for than income. We split it out using some detailed samples all the way from those making under $24,000 a year. But among that lower income group, 34% are voting for Romney, 58% for Obama. Mm-hmm. And you go up to the top end of the scale, 180 plus, that's as high as we go. It's 52% for Romney. So it skews towards Romney, but by no means overwhelmingly. So income is there, but it's not a huge predictor.
That was a whole long list of things. Is there one thing that is determinant of how people vote?
We like to look at demographics. And, you know, the most important factor this year is race and ethnicity, by far, in determining who you're going to vote for. Second, how religious you are in our analysis here at Gallup, and also if you're married or not.
Can you say then, Frank, that candidates are gearing campaigns toward race at all? I mean, do you see that?
Well, I'm not sure that candidates are gearing their campaigns to race and ethnicity, although obviously we've seen a major press on both sides toward the Latino vote. But it's just a staple of American politics today, that if you are not white, it's a major dividing variable, such that some analysts simply say the real key to this election is going to be what percent of non-whites turn out and vote, because non-whites are going to be 75% or 80% voting for Barack Obama.
One of the things that's happened in this campaign is that it has been punctuated by a series of gaffes, right? There have been, you know, you didn't build that. There's been all kinds of them, of which this is only the latest. Do you see in your polls any of these gaffes, the economic gaffes specifically, having an enduring impact? I mean, we still have like 7 weeks to go before Election Day.
We sure do. It's a good question. I've been monitoring elections since 1992, so this is my sixth election.
Wow.
And I would say, Kai, gaffes come and gaffes go. How's that? I don't think these kinds of things generally stick. I think the convention for Obama had an impact, at least in the short term. The debates may. But these gaffes and news events that erupt quickly and then kind of fade away, it's unclear that most of them have much effect on who people are going to vote for.
And that's why you have the election in the first place. Frank Newport is the editor-in-chief at Gallup. The segment he's here for every single week is called Attitude Check. Frank, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
There's a reason the Chicago teacher strike got so much press. It's because, in part anyway, the strike was about a whole lot more than just Chicago or Chicago teachers. It was about how to fix really troubled schools, about how long a school day should be, about how to evaluate good teachers and keep them and not keep the ones who aren't so good. In Chicago, tenure protections survived in the new contract, but around the country, states are trying to make it easier to fire ineffective teachers. Which gets us to this. What is tenure at the K-12 level anyway, and why do teachers have it? From the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR, Amy Scott reports.
Jeff Merle taught junior high in a Cleveland suburb in the 70s. After 3 years on the job, he showed up at the school board meeting to hear his name ring out among the newly tenured teachers. The union president laughed at him.
And he said, what do you think tenure is? And I said, well, I'll have job security for the rest of my life. He said, no. What tenure does is it guarantees that you have an orderly dismissal.
That is, Merle couldn't be fired without a reason and a hearing. Now he has the lifetime guarantee kind of tenure as a professor of educational studies at the University of Michigan. He says first grade teachers have tenure for the same reason academics do. It started in the early 1900s to protect teachers from being fired, to make room for the superintendent's nephew, or say for teaching evolution in biology class.
You know, it gave teachers some job security in a world in which political allegiances mattered more than what you knew how to teach and your ability to teach it.
But those protections have made it hard and expensive to fire ineffective teachers. Sandy Jacobs is vice president of the National Council on Teacher Quality. She says it can cost $200,000 in legal fees to fire one teacher. Often, she says, school bosses don't bother.
That's why we hear tenure so frequently equated with, you know, lifetime employment. That's not technically what it means, but that's become the reality in a lot of places.
Jacobs says several states have passed or are working on laws to make tenure tougher to get and easier to lose. Former teacher Rob Cooper is now a lawyer in Chicago. He's helped districts get rid of dozens of ineffective teachers.
You do it precisely, do it carefully, make certain that the teacher's rights are regarded. It's not a difficult process.
Cooper says weak teachers show their weaknesses early, and the best way to avoid expensive battles is not to give them tenure in the first place. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
The Department of Labor released its annual list of the most dangerous jobs in the country today. Fishermen, loggers, pilots, garbage men, and roofers were numbers 1 through 5. You gave us a couple online today.
Most dangerous? Running around in costume as a character at Disney World. 90-degree weather with high humidity and trying not to accidentally whack someone with your ears if you turn around quickly.
At 8, I was working on the farm, nearly lost my hand a few times. At 16, in a butcher shop, almost lost a finger. At 21, joined the Army. Several near misses.
I've been a programmer for the past 15 years, sitting on a chair for 8, sometimes 10 hours a day. That's nearly 30,000 hours on a chair. Oh yeah, and junk food.
That last one just hurts, man. Send us yours, the most dangerous jobs you ever had. Facebook is good, or Twitter. We're at Marketplace APM. Coming up, no, come on, voicemails? That is so lame.
The internet phone company Vonage crunched some numbers recently for USA Today and concluded that the number of voice messages on the service has fallen almost 10%.
But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, mixed again today. The Dow Industrials added 18 points, a tenth of 1%, 13,596 for the blue chips at the bell. The NASDAQ off 6 points, 0.2%, 3,175. The S&P 500 dropped a tiny fraction of 1%, not even a single point, finished at 1,460. Bed Bath & Beyond needed a towel after the bath its stock took today. Shares fell 9.75%. Norfolk Southern chugged backward more than 9% today after the railroad company cut its earnings forecast on worries the economy is going to continue to slow. Investors withdrew more than 1% from shares of Bank of America after that layoff news we mentioned up the top of the broadcast. Bonds unchanged. The yield on the 10-year T-note held steady at 1.77%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here is a look at events coming up Friday. Darden, the restaurant company that owns Red Lobster and Olive Garden, releases their quarterly earnings. The Endeavour space shuttle lands at the Los Angeles International Airport after a journey across the country. It'll be part of a permanent exhibit in L.A. And speaking of journeys, 75 years ago today, J.R.R. Tolkien's The Hobbit first hit bookstore shelves. I'm Bridget Bodner.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Imagine, if this makes sense to you, the entire state of Texas just melting away, disappearing completely. Now consider that that's how much smaller the Arctic ice cap is this year than its previous record melt just 5 years ago. With the obligatory caveat that global warming is most definitely not a good thing, there will be some winners out of this. The shipping industry, for one, which is going to be able to take some global shortcuts up north. But that might just make the warming thing even worse. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong has that story.
The downward plunge in ice mirrors a separate chart trending up. That'd be the prospects of an ice-free shipping waterway across the roof of the Earth. It's still experimental. 34 ships made the trek last year, carrying more than 800,000 tons of fish and minerals and gas. This year should surpass that, which makes Nick Nuttall nervous. He's spokesman for the UN Environmental Program. You see, ships spew not just CO2, but soot, which darkens the ice.
So that the Arctic and the glaciers on mountains can't reflect the heat back into space, and as a result you get accelerated melting. So we've got a kind of unvirtuous circle.
In London today, a panel in Parliament pushed a halt to Arctic shipping. Still, industry consultant Paul Bingham at CDM Smith figures it's just a matter of time before it goes commercial. Sailing over the top can cut a trip by 30%, which of course means less fuel and less carbon dioxide spewed.
If we do this, we're actually going to substantially reduce our emissions. It's perhaps not so simplistic in terms of what the real costs and benefits are.
Maybe. But shipping and oil companies in the Arctic surely will take their hits in public. Is it fair? Energy professor Daniel Kamen at Berkeley doesn't think so.
Blaming industry is a cop-out because industry is supposed to react in fair and legal ways to the rules they're given.
The key, in his view, is for the Arctic nations to get the environmental rules right before industry and the melting race ahead. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
The Department of Housing and Urban Development did an experiment almost 20 years ago. It offered some families who needed housing vouchers to pay the rent. There was, of course, a catch. They had to move to a new neighborhood, a better one with a poverty rate below 10%. The government has been tracking those families ever since. It released the data today, and it shows what a new neighborhood can change and what it can't. Mary Harris has that story.
Moving to opportunity. The name alone tells you what HUD hoped would happen when more than 800 families left their crime-ridden housing projects behind. But almost two decades later, their overall family income, their likelihood of going on welfare, it all remained the same. University of Chicago economist Jens Ludwig has tracked these families from the start.
To get and keep a good job, a bunch of things need to go right in your life. So changing neighborhoods didn't necessarily change the mom's schooling attainment and her attractiveness to employers in the labor market who are looking for high school graduates or people with some college training.
For families that moved, the mothers were 40% less likely to be extremely obese. Their rates of diabetes plummeted. Doctors say these changes may be the result of reduced stress, and the families were happier. Professor Ludwig says that's worth a lot.
Moving from a high-poverty neighborhood into a lower-poverty neighborhood increases your happiness by about as much as an increase in earnings of about $13,000 a year.
It seems like good news, but more and more Americans are moving the opposite way. The last decade saw a boom in neighborhoods with a high concentration of poor residents. Elizabeth Kneebone studies this trend at the Brookings Institution.
By the end of the 2000s, we were looking at almost 9 million people living in very poor neighborhoods. And so we saw an increase of over 2.1 million, almost actually 2.2 million people in those areas.
Which means those Americans could be missing out on the benefits of living a healthy life. And that's worth something. In New York, I'm Mary Harris for Marketplace.
Our man in Shanghai, Rob Schmitz, has been out and about lately trying to learn how the Chinese feel about the way their economy's going. It's no small question because the world's second biggest economy gets a whole new set of political leaders this coming October. So Rob's been riding the rails, talking to people. Trains are still the most common form of transportation over there. Yesterday for Rob, it was a long, slow trip through China's poorest province. Today, he's moved up a gear or two to the speedy bullet train from Shanghai to Beijing.
10 years ago, trains in China sounded like this. Noisy, overcrowded, smoky, filthy. It wasn't uncommon to be sharing your bench with live chickens in wicker baskets. You can still ride these trains. They're in rural China, where half the country's population lives. But this is how China's other half rides. The first-class cabin of a bullet train in Shanghai is as noisy as a library. Attendants hand out bottled water and snacks to businessmen settling in for the journey. After speeding through the rice fields of eastern China at 200 miles an hour, the train will coast into Beijing, covering the distance between New York City and Chicago in under 5 hours. Businessman Ani Chun's got a window seat. He owns a company that makes industrial-sized sewing machines. He's getting off the train at the route's halfway point to see clients. He makes this trip twice a month.
This used to be a 10-hour bus ride. I'd leave in the morning and arrive in the evening, a whole day wasted on the road. Now it's a 3-hour train ride, and I have my day back. The new train has helped me make more money.
This is exactly what China's government was hoping its new high-speed rail network would do. An says China's recent infrastructure boom has improved living standards for millions of East Coast Chinese like him. But just when it feels like he's dishing out state propaganda, he begins a list of complaints for the incoming leadership.
We still have a long way to go. Look at our healthcare system. It's way behind what you'd get in foreign countries. We have to pay so much for decent care, and quality care is hard to find.
China's economic planners are busy trying to figure out how to transition from an economic growth model based on building things to one based on people buying things, like the U.S. model. An says that's going to be tough. China's health insurance program isn't developed, and most Chinese like him are saving money for medical emergencies instead of spending it.
If foreigners make $5, they'll spend $3. We Chinese may only spend $1 or $2.
Behind An is architect and professor Ren Fei, sitting with his daughter. She just graduated from college, and he's taking her to see Beijing. Ren thinks before China's new government heralds in an age of consumerism, it should probably turn to what he thinks is China's largest problem.
We really need to help rural China. This is China's biggest challenge. Cities like Shanghai are very modern, but the countryside lags far behind. Our potential as a country lies in bringing our own people out of poverty.
Ren says the gap between rural and urban China, between rich and poor, is the least understood aspect of China among foreigners.
They only see the part of China that's reported in the news. If they do come to China, they visit the cities. But most of China isn't urban, so I don't think they understand China.
I ask Ren if his daughter has visited rural China. He blushes.
No, she hasn't, but she should go and take a look at some point.
Ren's daughter looks out the window at a village flashing by. She's listening to music on her iPhone, oblivious to our conversation. On his laptop, businessman Zhou Yongli has a diversion of his own. Harry Potter. He kindly sets aside Hogwarts to discuss Communist Party politics. Zhou's company makes machinery that cooks French fries for McDonald's and KFC. Both chains are on a franchise building spree in China, and Joe's busy. China's middle class wants more fries. Ask him what he's looking for in China's new leadership. Joe's very careful about how he phrases his answer, so he uses an analogy about what he knows best, food.
If China's economy is a pie, and if one entity, one party, gets a bigger part, then everyone else has less.
Joe's smile warns me to move on to another topic. Outside, the train has come to a stop in Chufu, the birthplace of Confucius. A massive yellow billboard outside invites people to step off a train from China's future to come and explore China's past. Nobody in the car gets up. Ignoring his nervousness about discussing politics, I ask Zhou how China's government can solve this pie problem of his. Zhou looks outside at the Confucius billboard and smiles. In an answer that seems to channel the communication style of the ancient sage, he tells me, it's very simple to solve, but for those who have the power to solve it, it's very difficult. The doors close. Next stop, Beijing. From the Shanghai to Beijing bullet train, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
We've got a slideshow of Rob's ride and a map of where he's been on our website, marketplace.org. And now to one of the most nagging dilemmas of our time. Do you text? Or do you call? Commentator Rob Walker says how we use our phones says a lot about us.
I think I'll let that go to voicemail. I'm not getting as much voicemail as I used to, and it's not just me. The internet phone company Vonage, for instance, crunched some numbers recently for USA Today and concluded that the number of voice messages on the service has fallen almost 10%. There's got to be a message in that statistic, and if your guess is that it has to do with texting, I'd say you are on to something. That's the letters U and R, by the way. Texting is faster. You don't have to wait through an outgoing message. You can skip the verbal niceties, and frankly, you can skip the basics of grammar and syntax. You can text while standing in line at Starbucks, watching Monday Night Football, or pretending to be engaged in a staff meeting. Plus, you avoid that nagging anxiety about whether your voicemail will ever be heard at all. A feeling that is not misplaced. Vonage says retrieved voicemail has fallen 13%. Okay, time for full disclosure. I'm a texting resistor. I can't stand that feeling of being always available. I even tell people my mobile phone doesn't receive texts, so they'll have to leave voicemail. Some refuse to believe me or are so dismissive of voicemail they won't leave one. And later they ask me, "Didn't you get my text?" I suspect this shift to texting is only partly about efficiency. I mean, voicemail isn't that onerous. I think this is really about a power struggle of sorts. What we all want is the ability to get our own messages across this second and to answer others in our own sweet time. For senders, texting works even if the recipient is right in the middle of... Oh, I actually got to take this. Keep in touch. Okay?
Yeah, okay. Rob Walker is the co-editor of the book Significant Objects, 100 Remarkable Stories About Unremarkable Things. We actually had him on to talk about it not too long ago. Kind of interesting. There's a link to that interview on our website, marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, which is at the same time amazing and kind of sweet if you think about it. The CEO of CBS, Les Moonves, was speaking at a conference in New York today about the television business, new media, a whole bunch of things. And at one point, the Los Angeles Times reports, Moonves said syndication, repeats, are the cash cow, not online stuff. Exhibit A, Moonves said, "I Love Lucy." Yes, that, "I Love Lucy," still makes CBS $20 million a year. That is unreal. All right, we got to go. John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, George Judson, Jonathan Karp, Sylvester Monroe, Dave Shaw, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The acting managing editor is Ethan Lindsay. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow. This is APM.